Chapter 4 Ransom's legs failed him, and he must have sunk back upon the bed, but he only became aware of this many minutes later. At the moment he was unconscious of everything except his fear. He did not even know what he was afraid of. The fear itself possessed his whole mind, a formless, infinite misgiving. He did not lose consciousness, though he greatly wished that he might do so. Any change, death or sleep, or best of all, a waking which would show all this for a dream, would have been inexpressibly welcome. None came. Instead, the lifelong self-control of social man, the virtues which are half hypocrisy, or the hypocrisy which is half a virtue, came back to him, and soon he found himself answering Weston in a voice not shamefully tremulous. "Do you mean that?" he asked. "Certainly." "Then where are we?"
"Standing out from Earth about 85,000 miles."
"You mean we're in space?"
Ransom uttered the word with difficulty, as a frightened child speaks of ghosts or a frightened man of cancer.
Weston nodded.
"What for?" said Ransom. "And what on earth have you kidnapped me for? And how have you done it?"
For a moment Weston seemed disposed to give no answer. Then, as if on a second thought, he sat down on the bed beside Ransom and spoke as follows.
"I suppose it will save trouble if I deal with these questions at once, instead of leaving you to pester us with them every hour for the next month. As to how we do it, I suppose you mean how the spaceship works. There's no good your asking that. Unless you were one of the 4 or 5 real physicists now living, you couldn't understand. And if there were any chance of your understanding, you certainly wouldn't be told. If it makes you happy to repeat words that don't mean anything, which is in fact what unscientific people want when they ask for an explanation, you may say we work by exploiting the less observed properties of solar radiation. As to why we are here, we are on our way to Malacandra."
"Do you mean a star called Malacandra?"
"Even you can hardly suppose we are going out of the solar system. Malacandra is much nearer than that. We shall make it in about 28 days."
"Well, there isn't a planet called Malacandra," objected Ransom.
"I am giving it its real name, not the name invented by terrestrial astronomers," said Weston.
"Oh, but surely this is nonsense," said Ransom. "How the deuce did you find out its real name, as you call it?"
"From the inhabitants."
It took Ransom some time to digest this statement. "Do you mean to tell me you claim to have been to this star before, or this planet, or whatever it is?"
"Yes."
"You can't really ask me to believe that," said Ransom. "Damn it all, it's not an everyday affair. Why has no one heard of it? Why has it not been in all the papers?"
"Because we are not perfect idiots," said Weston gruffly.
After a few moments' silence, Ransom began again. "Which planet is it in our terminology?" he asked.
"Once and for all," said Weston, "I am not going to tell you. If you know how to find out when we get there, you are welcome to do so. I don't think we have much to fear from your scientific attainments. In the meantime, there is no reason for you to know."
"And you say this place is inhabited?" said Ransom. Weston gave him a peculiar look and then nodded. The uneasiness which this produced in Ransom rapidly merged in an anger which he had almost lost sight of amidst the conflicting emotions that beset him. "And what has all this to do with me?" he broke out. "You have assaulted me, drugged me, and are apparently carrying me off as a prisoner in this infernal thing. What have I done to you? What do you say for yourself?"
"I might reply by asking you why you crept into my backyard like a thief. If you had minded your own business, you would not be here. As it is, I admit that we have had to infringe your rights. My only defense is that small claims must give way to great. As far as we know, we are doing what has never been done in the history of man, perhaps never in the history of the universe. We have learned how to jump off the speck of matter on which our species began. Infinity, and therefore perhaps eternity, is being put into the hands of the human race. You cannot be so small-minded as to think that the rights or the life of an individual, or of a million individuals, are of the slightest importance in comparison with this."
"I happen to disagree," said Ransom, "and I always have disagreed, even about vivisection. But you haven't answered my question. What do you want me for? What good am I to do you on this, on Malacandra?"
"That I don't know," said Weston. "It was no idea of ours. We're only obeying orders."
"Whose?" There was another pause.
"Come," said Weston at last. "There is really no use in continuing this cross-examination. You keep on asking me questions I can't answer. In some cases, because I don't know the answers, in others, because you wouldn't understand them. It will make things very much pleasanter during the voyage if you can only resign your mind to your fate and stop bothering yourself and us. It would be easier if your philosophy of life were not so insufferably narrow and individualistic. I had thought no one could fail to be inspired by the role you are being asked to play, that even a worm, if it could understand, would rise to the sacrifice. I mean, of course, the sacrifice of time and liberty and some little risk. Don't misunderstand me.
Well, said Ransom, you hold all the cards, and I must make the best of it. I consider your philosophy of life raving lunacy. I suppose all that stuff about affinity and eternity means you think you are justified in doing anything, absolutely anything, here and now, on the off chance that some creatures or other descended from man, as we know him, may crawl about a few centuries longer in some part of the universe.
Yes, anything whatever, returned the scientist sternly, and all educated opinion, for I do not call classics and history and such trash education, is entirely on my side. I'm glad you raised the point, and I advise you to remember my answer. In the meantime, if you will follow me into the next room, we will have breakfast. Be careful how you get up. Your weight here is hardly appreciable compared with your weight on Earth.
Ransom rose, and his captor opened the door. Instantly the room was flooded with a dazzling golden light, which completely eclipsed the pale earthlight behind him.
"I will give you darkened glasses in a moment," said Weston, as he preceded him into the chamber whence the radiance was pouring. It seemed to Ransom that Weston went up a hill towards the doorway and disappeared suddenly downwards when he had passed it. When he followed, which he did with caution, he had the curious impression that he was walking up to the edge of a precipice. The new room beyond the doorway seemed to be built on its side, so that its farther wall lay almost in the same plane as the floor of the room he was leaving. When, however, he ventured to put forward his foot, he found that the floor continued flush, and as he entered the second room, the walls suddenly righted themselves, and the rounded ceiling was over his head. Looking back, he perceived that the bedroom, in its turn, was now heeling over, its roof a wall, and one of its walls a roof.
"You'll soon get used to it," said Weston, following his gaze. "The ship is roughly spherical, and now we are outside the gravitational field of the Earth, down means and feels towards the centre of our own little metal world. This, of course, was foreseen, and we built her accordingly. The core of the ship is a hollow globe. We keep our stores inside it, and the surface of that globe is the floor we are walking on. The cabins are arranged all around this, their walls supporting an outer globe, which, from our point of view, is the roof. As the centre is always down, the piece of floor you are standing on always feels flat or horizontal, and the wall you are standing against always seems vertical. On the other hand, the globe of floor is so small that you can always see over the edge of it, over what would be the horizon if you were a flea, and then you see the floors and wall of the next cabin in a different plane. It is just the same on Earth, of course, only we are not big enough to see it. After this explanation, he made arrangements, in his precise, ungracious way, for the comfort of his guest, or prisoner. Ransom, at his advice, removed all his clothes, and substituted a little metal girdle hung with enormous weights to reduce, as far as possible, the unmanageable lightness of his body. He also assumed tinted glasses, and soon found himself seated opposite Weston at a small table laid for breakfast. He was both hungry and thirsty, and eagerly attacked the meal, which consisted of tinned meat, biscuit, butter, and coffee. But all these actions he had performed mechanically, stripping, eating, and drinking passed almost unnoticed, and all he ever remembered of his first meal in the spaceship was the tyranny of heat and light. Both were present in a degree which would have been intolerable on Earth, but each had a new quality. The light was paler than any light of comparable intensity that he had ever seen. It was not pure white, but the palest of all imaginable golds, and it cast shadows as sharp as a floodlight. The heat, utterly free from moisture, seemed to knead and stroke the skin like a gigantic masseur. It produced no tendency to drowsiness, rather intense alacrity. His headache was gone. He felt vigilant, courageous, and magnanimous, as he had seldom felt on Earth. Gradually he dared to raise his eyes to the skylight. Steel shutters were drawn across all but a chink of the glass, and that chink was covered with blinds of some heavy and dark material. But still it was too bright to look at.
"I always thought space was dark and cold," he remarked vaguely.
"Forgotten the sun?" said Weston contemptuously. Ransom went on eating for some time. Then he began,
"If it's like this in the early morning," and stopped, warned by the expression on Weston's face. Awe fell upon him. There were no mornings here, no evenings, and no night, nothing but the changeless noon which had filled for centuries beyond history so many millions of cubic miles. He glanced at Weston again, but the latter held up his hand. "Don't talk," he said. "We have discussed all that is necessary. The ship does not carry oxygen enough for any unnecessary exertion, not even for talking." Shortly afterwards he rose, without inviting the other to follow him, and left the room by one of the many doors which Ransom had not yet seen opened.